BoatShield wasn't satisfied with any of the bike lubes on the market, so they engineered their own. Their research proved that none of the Teflon, silicone, or synthetic formulas held up when exposed to dusty, dirty, and muddy conditions. For that reason, BoatShield T9 is designed to offer long-term lubrication and protection in any environment. BoatShield T9 waterproofs your bike chain, lubricates cables, and prevents rust with its effective all-in-one formula. The paraffin-based lube flushes out dirt and old lubricants, displaces moisture, and penetrates moving parts. Then it dries to a clean, continuous wax film that performs better than Teflon and lasts up to 200 miles. BoatShield T9 is designed to resist picking up dust, dirt, or mud, which makes it a good choice for all riding conditions. This month, BoatShield is giving away a free prize pack to a lucky listener. Go to singletracks.com/BoatShield to enter, and visit BoatShield.com to learn more, or click the links in the show notes. Hey everybody, welcome to the Single Tracks Podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Jason Fennell. Jason is a mountain biker who works with the Scaola Foundation, an organization that's working with Boys and Girls Clubs locations to start on-site mountain bike programs. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. I appreciate you guys taking time to have us on and talk to us.
Well, how did you get started with mountain biking?
Yeah, so, biking in general, I lived in a pretty neat little neighborhood. I had a bunch of kids. And so I was on a bike at an early age, right? But I riding around the neighborhood, going to the pool, basketball games, all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. Everything with the neighborhood kids. But then, I want to say, I guess the time I was probably 10, 11, maybe, my dad got a job and he with Lightspeed Titanium in, Ootewah, Tennessee. And,
yeah.
And he was their VP of sales. He didn't really have any mountain biking or cycling background before that, but was friends with family that owned the company, and they knew he had a pretty strong sales background, and so they talked for a little bit, and then he got hired. And next thing you know, I was being dragged along and tagged along with him, and was sort of plunged into this world of cycling, and it was just something that I had no idea existed. And I just went from, I guess, no level of awareness to probably the highest level of awareness that you could get, from traveling to the Norba National races, the old pro circuit stuff back in the 90s, to having, Lightspeed. They were in the early 90s. It was a pretty high-end tech. Titanium was pretty high-end stuff. And so, highly sought after, even the big names, John Tomac and Tinker Juarez and all those guys, they tended to gravitate towards our booth, and got a lot of exposure to those types, and saw, traveled to a bunch of races, and got to race some, real early as a kid, and it was just a baptism, so to speak, of, by fire, because it was, I went from just being like every other kid in the world that rides their bike, kind of, part transportation, part fun, went from that to, riding races in the Pisgah Mountains in North Carolina, and pretty much did it overnight. Right.
Yeah.
Always had, definitely had sort of a traditional sports background, baseball, basketball, football, wrestling, And definitely was very competitive, I guess, at everything that I did. And so, even though I didn't really have a lot of training time or experience at that age, and even on up into, 15, 16 years old, anything I showed up to, I definitely wanted to win, wanted mm-hmm. to do my best. And so, but real quickly, you got to see sort of the gaps between the kids that made it a lifestyle, and that's what they were doing. They were riding every day, and then sort of the part timers, which is really what I was. But just an incredible experience. Got to really be immersed in all of cycling culture, pretty much at the highest levels, and had all kinds of access and really cool experiences. And probably was the only 11-year-old or 12-year-old at the time that had a custom Okoe, titanium mountain bike tricked out with, XTR and RockShox and all the cool stuff of the 90s, just completely, did not understand what I had until many, many years later when, my dad was no longer with the company and I'm trying to, buy my own first real bike. It's like, man, this stuff's expensive.
So, right.
Yeah. But yeah, been around it a long time, and, it's been a big part of my life, and really thankful for those times and those experiences. And it certainly sort of shaped the way that I guess I chose my recreation time moving forward for the rest of my life. So it's a big part of you know, who I am and what I enjoy. And yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, I'm interested too. I mean, you don't hear a lot of people like your dad who sort of go into the bike industry without really being like, you know, really, I don't know, lack of a better word, enthusiastic, or, you know, they're just people who are already into cycling. And I'm curious to know, did your dad like get into it once he joined the company? Did he start riding recreationally, or was that just something that like he kept separate, but that you picked up on?
No, he definitely was involved, you know. He would do races too. I think he raced, you know, mainly sport class and that sort of thing. And I guess kind of realized what a jump there was between sport and expert. And then just as big of a jump, if not more so, from expert to pro. And, but he was, you know, kind of like me. He had more of a traditional sports background, but look, it's impossible to be around that stuff and not, you know, get bitten by the bug and the enthusiasm. And it's just, it's a, you know, an entire subculture or culture, I guess, at this point. And, no, he was eaten up with it. He still rides today, even though he's been out of the industry for quite some time now. But, it became very quickly a big part of sort of our family lifestyle and what we did. And back in the early 90s, I guess it was really probably before Sorba chapters really began to sort of mobilize, especially in this area. And, you know, we didn't have massive amounts of trail without, you know, pretty substantial travel. When we wanted to ride, it was for the most part, it was load up and hop in the car and go to a national forest, which was, you know, an hour away. And there was some single track, but it certainly wasn't necessarily super well designed and well built and all that kind of stuff. Whereas, you know, now in the last 10, 15, 20 years, what EMBA and Sorba, and certainly our local, the Northwest Georgia Sorba chapters and then the Chattanooga Sorba chapters have just, they've covered this area. This area is blanketed in just amazing trail systems. I would say, well, actually I looked it up earlier. I think we have 5 major trail systems that they have developed, within probably a 15-mile radius of downtown Chattanooga, and over 75 miles of single track. You know, and that was something we didn't have in the early 90s. If we were going to ride something local, we were probably poaching it.
Right.
And, you know, nowadays, actually some of those places that we poached are now, you know, they're part of the sort of systems. But yeah, it definitely was something he adopted and adapted to. And, you know, I think he fell in love with it as much as I did. And to this day, he still watches the tour and keeps up with that. And,
wow, cool.
And, you know, me too. It became a big part of our lives.
Cool. Well, tell us about the Scaiola Foundation. How did it get started and what's sort of the mission?
Yeah, so it got started after I graduated college. I was doing some nonprofit fundraising work for a private school in Chattanooga called Macaulay School. And was there for 5 or 6 years and then took a job as sort of the head of the development office, the fundraising department at the Boys and Girls Club in Northwest Georgia, which is, was based out of Dalton, Georgia. And, we had a particular donor there that, had given, some money to, buy bikes for the kids, for the clubs to keep on site, and a trailer to take the kids to a local trail system is about 5 miles away. Actually it was less than that. I'm going to say it was probably closer to 2 or 3 miles away. But, so when I showed up, that was sort of already in place, and I saw the kids, the daily access to the kids that we had. And, you know, it was 150, 200 kids a day that were in that particular club. Mm-hmm. And, the trailer and taking the kids to that mountain bike park. It was called Raisin Woods Mountain Bike Park. And I thought, wow, this is super cool. And that was in the summer program that we did that. In the summer, they had the kids from basically 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., right? So pretty much 12-hour day. And I noticed, I guess, that once we transitioned to the fall, the after-school program, we only had the kids from like 3 to 5:30, 6:30, right, at the latest. So your window of opportunity to load kids up in a van, drive them down the road, load the bikes out, get the bikes out, ride, you know, for an hour or so, it was greatly diminished.
Yeah.
And so it realized pretty quickly, hey, as cool as the mountain bike program was, it was something that was super seasonal within the Boys and Girls Club model. Mm-hmm. One day, while kind of walking the back property, scratching my head, we had about 7 acres at the time, which is, an urban club, what's categorized as an urban Boys and Girls Club, it's a lot of land. Mm-hmm. But I kind of looked over at the bikes. I looked over at this land that was unused, and I went and talked to my boss and said, hey, we need to build something here where the kids can ride the bikes here at our club on site, and we can do it every day after school. And this could be, part of our programming, just like anything else that we do. And he said, well, how are you going to get it done? I said, well, let me go visit the local Sorba chapter and talk to these guys and see if they have an interest and would help me build it. And if they'd help me build it, that would really be the end of it.
Yeah.
We could ride the bikes every day and kind of go from there. So reached out to Sorba folks back then. It was Rick Moon. It was Jenny Dashinger. It was Gay Rice, Conrad Fernandez. They were kind of running the show, and most of them still are actually down in Northwest Georgia Sorba. But, they invited me to come to the meeting and kind of give my pitch, and I gave my pitch, and they said, hey, we'll get back to you next week. And they called me back and said, yep, let's do it. We'll bring, 10, 12 volunteers, and we'll make some sort of a small little pump track. So we did that.
Oh, cool.
It took us 2-3 days. We did it all by hand, shovels and,
wow.
and wheelbarrows. It was a lot. I don't know that any of us quite understood what we'd broken up. They probably did. I didn't. But we got the local bike shop involved at the time. It was Bear Creek Bike, Shane Adams, who was the owner of that. And it just got a lot of support. And over 2-3 days, we got it done. And the next year, that course just it got all kinds of riding. It was we were blown away. We couldn't, we started seeing user-created trails on the rest of the property, which for the most part was grown up and not functional. You had some people were using it to dump some washing machines and some mattresses and all kinds of nonsense back there. Well, we kind of put our heads together the following year and said, hey, let's do it again. And then somebody had a bright idea of, why don't we get a bobcat this time? So we talked to the boss and they're running the bobcat. And we tripled the size the next year.
Wow.
And we did that over 2 days, and then that carried on. And basically we did, one work day a year over the period of about 10 years. And before we knew it, we had, 5 acres of pretty well-developed trail system in place. We had, it's sort of a mix of BMX and pump track. And then we had a perimeter track that we put in with gravel that we compacted. It was about 0.3 miles, and we could run time trials and those types of things on that. But it ended up becoming, next to probably the homework help program that we did every day, it became probably the most marketable thing we did, and got a lot of support. Next thing you know, the local cyclist in the local cycling community got folks that didn't even have mountain bikes, but just were roadies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would hear about it and they would want to come over and see. And next thing you know, that person was a donor, and they would send in, an annual check of supporting it and saying, hey, let's keep these kids riding bikes. And it kind of blossomed from there. And the family that funded it all from the get-go, the Scaola family, Scaola Foundation, they saw this and were really pleased with, hey, we thought this was just kind of going to kind of be like a summer thing where the kids got to ride in the summer. Now they're literally riding every day. What if we put some more funding behind this and we tried to take this model and expand regionally? And then what if we try and take this model and expand nationally? And, they asked for a little bit of help, I guess, from our end in trying to get the next club up and running, which ended up being in Knoxville area, Tennessee. And a year after that, they came to me who at the time was, I was still an employee of the Boys and Girls Club, but they came to me and said, hey, we want you to try and help us grow this program. And we want to do about four of these a year. And so, you know, we've been sort of growing ever since. Right now we're in, I want to say 12 different locations. We're in, Georgia, Tennessee, and Alabama. And then right now we're actually in the process of reviewing, an application from Florida. So we may have our first, Florida club this year if everything goes well. And, you know, our goal is to help bring daily access to mountain biking to kids through the Boys and Girls Club model. It just makes a lot of sense, right? You have, when you partner with an organization like the Boys and Girls Club, they have the facilities, they have the kids, they have the time and the structure and the transportation and the insurance and all the additional things that you have to have for a program like this to exist on a daily basis. If we were to try and construct just a youth mountain biking program that, you know, that encompass these hours, you're talking about massive budgets required for something like that. You know, typically most of the clubs that we work with have between a half a million to a $2.5-3 million annual operating budget. Mm-hmm. You know, and most of that is overhead for staffing to have folks with the kids every day and insurance and utilities and all those things that if you really want to have a viable program, you have to have that. It's very difficult to run something that is a daily operating model. It's very difficult to run something like that purely on volunteer hours, right? Like you have to be able to pay staff to be there with the kids. And so anyway, you know, the family just saw that, hey, it makes a lot of sense to try and implement this model within, or this mountain bike program within the confines of the Boys and Girls Club system, because they know how to work with kids. They have the insurance, they have the facilities, they have the kids, they have the transportation to get the kids from the schools to the clubs. It's just, it's a number of things, and it just made a lot of sense. And next thing you know, here we are, and our goal is to continue to grow it and give kids more access to mountain bike opportunities and all of the benefits that come along with that. And they're vast. And I know you and your listeners know that as well. So,
yeah. Well, for those who aren't familiar with the Boys and Girls Club as an organization, who are these kids? Like what's kind of the mission of the Boys and Girls Club outside of, you know, mountain biking and homework help?
So I guess the mission of the Boys and Girls Club is technically, if you read it off the charter, it's to enable all young people, especially those who need it most, to reach their full potential as productive, caring, responsible citizens. Hmm. That's a nice mission statement. That's what's going to be on the websites. But I think more succinctly, it's an organization that exists to give kids opportunities. And in many cases, it's kids that are, would be traditionally considered underserved, in terms of socioeconomic status and things of that nature. Demographics, they vary wildly, and they kind of mirror their local communities, right? And so, you know, if you're talking about a Boys and Girls Club in downtown Atlanta compared to a Boys and Girls Club in rural, you know, Alabama, it could look very differently. But, you know, some trends that I have seen carry across for some of the clubs would be, you know, 50-60% single parent families. Mm-hmm. Between 50-90% of kids in particular organizations might be on free and reduced lunch programs.
Okay.
Wow. Ethnicity, it varies wildly. You know, it just depends on where the club's located. Mm-hmm. But you know, at the end of the day, it's about helping kids and giving kids opportunities to be successful. They really focus on education, character development, sports and activities. So like mountain biking falls very much sort of within the physical recreation component of a Boys and Girls Club. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, substance abuse prevention, healthy habits, healthy lifestyles. That's sort of the last tier. So, you know, something like mountain biking, it has a lot of ancillary, even though it might fit more neatly, I guess, under the sports and recreation banner. There are all kinds of ancillary benefits to it, you know, in terms of healthy lifestyles. And then, okay, well, because I've actually, I've detoxed from the screen for you know, that I've been sitting in front of all day. Now I can focus to do my reading homework or my history homework or my math homework, right? We just really found that it is super helpful in creating a more well-rounded experience for a child.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, yeah, when you're talking about sort of how this whole idea got rolling, and talking about the pump track, you know, I was really nodding along with you because, here where I live during this, you know, coronavirus lockdown, some local kids in our neighborhood built a pump track. It's probably calling it a pump track. It might be a little generous, but yeah. You know, they made some little jumps and berms, and it's more like a horseshoe pattern, and they didn't have permission. They did it in a local park, which, you know, we don't advise, but it was incredible to see just all the kids like showing up there and just riding it, and kids like all ages, you know, there's kids on those little scoot bikes, like they don't even have pedals, like 2 and 3 year old kids are rolling around along with, you know, there's high school kids there. You know, we would see people, you know, adults on road bikes or hybrid bikes kind of come by and check it out, and you know, they would all stop and be like, whoa, that looks really cool. And to me, yeah, the pump track is like, I was just blown away by how, I don't know, just how it like brings so many people together, and like it's for everybody, which is awesome. And like, so I'm not surprised at all to hear that this is, you know, what you guys found as well. I mean, that seems like a pretty key part of the model. And yeah, it just is something that I guess kids are really into.
Oh yeah. I mean, it makes so much sense on so many levels. I'll give you a quick story. Well, maybe more of an update, but so I got an email from Brian Dolan, who's the CEO of, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southeast Georgia. And they're one of the clubs that we funded, right? And COVID, every club's kind of handled how they've addressed this differently. But Brian, is one of the clubs that we funded, and they have a track and facility and all that kind of stuff. And, he sent me an email and said, hey, I just want to let you know, even though we've been shut down, because bringing kids inside for programming with staff and all those things, that's a very nuanced issue. There's a lot going on there. Even though we've been shut down, we've been handing out meals, to the kids. And we have opened up the mountain bike track for an hour a day. And we feel like we can do that safely. You know, it's very much sort of within the social distancing protocol, the way we're handling it. And, 40 kids a day, he said, were coming to ride for that hour, when they picked up their lunch. And so I just think that kind of dovetails with your story about the, you know, the local kids building one in their neighborhood. And it's an incredible outlet. And, you know, they get to have some fun, take some risk in a controlled environment, rather than taking some risk somewhere else where things might not be so controlled.
Right.
And that's reality for a lot of the kids that we serve in the Boys and Girls Club model. But, you know, cycling is one of those things, like you were talking about earlier. It's one of those things that's a lifelong skill. It is something that you can do from 5 years old to 80 years old. And so many of our kids, especially here in the U.S., they're sort of funneled through this varsity athlete paradigm. And it's, you know, what happens to the kid that, you know, didn't make the cut on the baseball team or the soccer team or whatever else? And so from our end, in terms of Boys and Girls Club programming, it just made so much sense. It made incredible sense to have a non-traditional sport like this that, you know, is exciting, it's engaging, but at the same time, you're getting immense cardiovascular benefits, you're getting increased focus in school, you know, psychological benefits. I could get into one story, and this is a little heartbreaking. I don't want to get too deep into the details, but we had one particular child who years ago was very highly medicated and was raised by his grandparents, and he really bought into the cycling program, so much so that he was typically, the way we would run it is, you know, certain age groups get access to the track, and to the riding is that's a block on their schedule for the day, right? And this particular kid loved it so much that he asked for basically an extra block. Hey, can I ride with the older kids during this period? And we accommodated him. And typically, you know, it's not something we do, but, long story short, he lost, a lot of weight. His doctors reduced his medication. His grandfather came one day, and I'll never forget this. He had tears in his eyes, and he literally said, this bike program has changed and potentially saved his life.
Wow.
And, it's powerful stuff. Yeah. And, you know, in many cases, these are kids that, would probably not have access to something like this. You know, I mean, if you think about mountain biking or cycling in general, it's, you know, there's a certain socioeconomic group that's typically participates in it, right? And so if your parents don't do that, or your uncle or your friends or whatever, the chances of you getting plugged in they're relatively small. And through this model, we're exposing kids to mountain biking that in many cases would most likely not ever have that opportunity, and they wouldn't get that exposure. And, it's just something that it's really exciting and we're really proud of. And we see it on the kids' faces when we, you know, when we have, mountain bike days and events, and all of a sudden when we go load them up to go to a trail system, it's a big deal. It's an event, you know, they're excited and they'll talk about it all week, and just the smiles that you get from it. And, you know, I just can't help but think we're doing kind of our part in the Boys and Girls Club and the Scaiola Foundation to help create lifelong cyclists. The namesake of the foundation was, Carlo Scaiola. He was the father, sort of the patriarch of the family. And he was actually Italian, and he was not necessarily a mountain biker, but he was a road cyclist, but just a passion for cycling. And you see it so many times when somebody gets introduced into the sport, whether it's road biking, mountain biking, whatever it is, and you start to realize, hey, there are levels to this thing. And, you know, I can go climb that mountain on this bike, or I can do this downhill descent, or I can, you know, just cycling's one of those things that, I think it engages people where they are, but at the same time gives them opportunities to stretch themselves and grow themselves and to experience some discomfort and to work through that discomfort and learn about who you really are on the inside. And I think you can do that more so in cycling than you can in a lot of sports. And it's just something we're really proud to be able to participate in and help with.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really cool. And yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I was going to ask you, you know, the benefits compared to other sports programs, but I think you covered it. I mean, cycling is unique in a lot of ways, and it is one of those things that can be a lifelong sport. You know, if you play football as a kid, like, you know, by the time you're an adult, it's kind of hard to find, you know, a group of people that want to get out and play football. But, you know, you can always mountain bike by yourself or with a small group or a big group, whatever you want.
That's right. You could be an extrovert. You could be an introvert. It doesn't matter. But, you know, for most folks, if you're talking about something like football, for most people that ends at 18, mm-hmm. you know. And maybe if you're elite, it might end at 21 or 22, you know, playing in college. But that's 99% of the people that have ever played a down of football. They're done by 21 or 22, where cycling is something you can carry on the rest of your life. And I'm not hating on traditional sports at all. I did those as well. And I think that's probably part of the reason I can appreciate cycling as much as I do, because I've done those things too. But I was a college athlete. I wrestled in college. But there's a very finite time that you can participate in those things. And not everybody can do it. You know, if you don't have X amount of athleticism, or if the person in your position in front of you is, you know, the next Michael Jordan or whatever it is, you know, kind of back to what I was saying just a minute ago, I think cycling is one of those things that meets you where you are, but then at the same time still allows you to grow. And, you know, you see You look at the 100-mile races and those things. I mean, a lot of people aren't hitting their peaks in that stuff until their late 30s or 40s, you know. And so you can develop, you know, the majority of your life you can work to develop on that stuff. And it's age group racing and all those things. There's always a, you know, another benchmark to work towards. And it's very, I guess, relative to where you are at the time. And that's one of the reasons we're so excited about it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Well, what do the kids think about mountain biking though, especially those who are, you know, have had more exposure to like ball sports and things like that? Like when given the choice, are they like excited about it? Are they like skeptical, you know, like why would I want to do this or that looks hard or are they just excited? Are they like, wow, yes, I get it.
Yeah. So culturally, in terms of preferences, I guess one of the biggest things that I've noticed is that kids don't have bikes and don't ride bikes in general like they used to, right? So when I was a kid in the 80s and 90s, everybody in the neighborhood had a bike. It was transportation. It was the first taste of freedom. You know, right. When you get that first bike, your world expands. The neighborhood gets bigger. Your friend group gets bigger. You know, you can go play games with the kids the next neighborhood over, whatever it is. And that's not the case today. I will never forget the first time, and I've seen many of them at this point, but the first time I saw a 16 or 17 year old at one of our Boys and Girls Clubs that did not know how to ride a bike, and I couldn't believe it. It was, yeah. And that's prevalent. And it was one of those things that was like, that's like walking or breathing or you know, breathing air, drinking water. I just, you know, I couldn't believe it. But, you know, I think there are a couple factors at play there. I think culturally, kids are different now than they were then. They can do a lot of their social interaction through a cell phone, through a screen, through video games, et cetera, et cetera. I think, some of the kids that we are having, that we have in our Boys and Girls Clubs, I think some of them live in neighborhoods where it might not necessarily be safe to ride. Mom and dad might not want them outside traveling the streets. I think, you know, lack of access in terms of, you know, maybe mom and dad can't necessarily afford to buy a bike for them. I think that's probably reality too. But, you know, it's not just with cycling. We notice that kids today, they don't go get driver's licenses. You know, they're not doing that at 16 years old. Whereas, you know, everybody I knew back when I was 16, it was the minute that the DMV opened. And just culturally, it's different.
Right.
So much of their interaction can be had through social media and those things. So they don't have to be transported someplace. They don't need that transportation access to have that social interaction. Right. But, and so I say all that to say the responses are varied, when a kid is first sort of met with it. Especially like the first time we take them out to a trail system, mm-hmm. and we go from riding, you know, as large as our facility is, to go from sort of a manicured BMX pump track / hybrid out to even the mildest mountain bike park where, you know, your shortest loop, we'll just say, is 3.5 miles. That's a very daunting thing for an 8-year-old. 3.5 miles. Oh my goodness. You know, that's further than it is to the store. I can't imagine something like that. And so, this is what we find. It kind of dovetails on what we were saying earlier in terms of kids get to reach, they get to push towards those limits. They get to push through those limits. And every time they do, their confidence grows,
right.
Their experience grows, their love of cycling and mountain biking in general, it grows once they realize, hey, if I push up through this, you know, if I hurt a little bit to climb this hill, well, then I get to enjoy the downhill on the backside. Right. And hey, maybe this hill that feels really big here on our facility, like on our Boys and Girls Club property, is pretty much nothing when I get to this mountain bike park, even the flattest, mildest one, right? And so, you know, in their minds, in many cases, you know, basically an inner city mountain bike park that's a wilderness experience for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's point to point riding on the Pinhoti, you know, it's that type of a thing, right? And so I've yet to see any kid that has been exposed to the program that has said, no, I don't like this. And 3 months later, have the same opinion.
Yeah.
Not a single kid. And, you know, from, and we try and have some skills features on our facilities as much as possible. Like teeter totters and skinnies and those things. And so, you know, a teeter totter can be a pretty daunting thing to an 8 year old.
Yeah.
And, you know, that foot and a half, 2 feet off the ground, it might as well be 20 if you're 7, 8 years old, right? Mm-hmm. And you're trying to coach them through it and say, hey, speed's your friend here. The only way that you're going to have a bad time on this thing is if we don't make it all the way up the teeter totter to the other side to where it's going to fall. Because as soon as it falls, you get to roll off and be the hero, right? But you've got to have some courage. You got to get outside of your comfort zone on this because you're going to want to hit it easy. And that's, it might be intuitive, but you're not going to have the response that you want from that. You're not going to get the success that you want from it. And so just moving kids through the process on something as simple as rolling over a teeter totter, a little 18 inch teeter totter, it does immense things for their self-confidence and, you know, their ability to push themselves and take risk. And I think that's part of the reason they like it so much. And it's, like I said earlier, it's in a, you know, a pretty controlled environment. We've got, you know, 18 inches of mulch under it. And if somebody does fall, maybe we get a little bump or a bruise, but for the most part, we're not having serious injuries and those types of things. It's more about, you know, sort of the managing that internal risk and that maybe that little voice in our head that says, oh, it's scary, I don't want to do it, and kind of battling back with the, well, you know, I can do it. I've got to try. I've got to push myself a little bit. And whether that's climbing a hill that makes your legs hurt and your lungs hurt, or whether that's, you know, doing a little drop in off of a berm on a user created trail that they made on one of our facilities, it's all those things. And so, you know, there's something there for all of them. And, you know, it kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier. It, mountain biking, cycling, once again, it kind of meets you where you are. And then you get to grow from there.
Yeah. Yeah. I love what you said too about, you know, climbing a hill and then getting to enjoy the descent on the other side. I mean, that's such a perfect metaphor for life in general, I think. Yeah. I mean, you know, put in the hard work so you can enjoy life, you know, later or at some point. I mean, just your day, just get through your day, you know, right? Like you got to go to work. And then when you're off of work, like you can have fun and be satisfied that you worked hard and, you know, enjoy the fruits of your labor. And
that's right. And that goes along with, I mean, the kind of the message that we push to the kids is it pretty much mirrors exactly what you said and like to share with them. Hey, there's not much in life where you're going to have, there's not much valuable that you're going to get that you don't have to work hard for, you know, and if you want that juice, you got to put in the squeeze, but the juice is worth the squeeze.
So. Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Well, through your experience and working with the Scaola Foundation, what have you found, or like what's sort of the emphasis? Is it on building accessible trails at the facilities, or getting the equipment that the kids need? Like, can you have one without the other, or is one need like greater than the other in these communities that you serve?
Yeah, so every club's different, right? You know, we might have a club that has a really large Sorba chapter in close proximity, and they're willing to sort of help construct the facility. We might have a club that has a really strong bike shop, and they're willing to maybe get the bikes donated at cost. So everyone's different, and we try not to, you know, micromanage that process too much. But we know this isn't cheap, right? And so in our minds, it's a sizable grant. Typically, our grantees, they're going to receive somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000. And they can use that for, you know, having the trail built, buying bikes, whatever it is that they need to do to make the program a viable program. And, you know, our goal is that, we have enough of a facility on site that the kids can ride for an hour and not get bored. That's really the goal. And that can be accomplished. You'd be amazed in, you know, how small of a piece of land is required for that. I mean, we can get that done in a half an acre. It's certainly an acre. You know, you pair together, you know, a walking track or a perimeter track or something where, the kids can get some flat pedal space in too. I think having that time trial component there is, I think that's a big deal. You know, it's not just about the rollers and the berms. It's about being able to push yourself against the clock or against somebody else on the clock, your buddy on the clock, right? So that's a part of it too. You know, but it's both, right? We've got to have equipment. We've got to have facilities. And our goal through this, more so than anything, is daily access to riding for the kids. You know, having a bike trail system close is great. But for our kids in the Boys and Girls Club, we want them to be able to ride every day, you know, weather permitting. And so we've got to have on-site facilities, and we got to have decent bikes. Our standard for the bikes is we want bike shop quality bikes. We want bikes that are serviceable. Because repairs, that's part of the deal, right? Like if you have 100 kids or 150 kids cycling through those bikes, typically 15, 20 bikes is what most clubs buy. But if you have 150 kids riding those things 5 days a week, you're going to have repairs that need to be done. You know, we really try and be strategic about pulling in a sort of chapter and a bike shop to try and help, be sort of the godparents to the program, if you will. Those two pieces are critical, but, you know, to answer your question, yeah, both. We've got to have good facilities, and we've got to have, you know, quality bikes for the kids to ride, because that's, at the end of the day, those two things they're going to be pretty significant drivers in the type of experience the kids have.
Yeah. Are the kids involved at all in maintaining the bikes?
Yeah. And so every club is different, and everybody kind of has their own protocols, but we have, you know, some clubs that's part of the daily process. So you'll literally check out your bike and your helmet like you're checking out a library book. They'll have a checklist that you work through in terms of checking the air pressure, you know, checking the seat height, you know, things that I guess, you know, if you've been cycling for a while, you might take for granted, but, our kids, they're not going to know those things if we don't teach them, right? Seat height's one of those that it's a constant battle, especially with the younger kids trying to get them to buy into that part of it. But, yes, so maintenance is definitely part of it. We've seen, some clubs use it as a teaching tool for physics, talking about gearing ratios and shifting and, you know, workloads and those things. You know, like I said, I was a wrestler in college. I took, geology. They didn't let me in the physics class, but there are a lot of, math and science lessons that you can extrapolate from a bike. And we've seen clubs do that as well. So yeah, we've even seen, more of a social component, like, hey, you know, we have to take care of our bikes the same way we would take care of our neighborhoods. You know, if one particular group is neglecting the bikes, then that's going to impact another group. You know, I've heard lessons in terms of that as well. So I think what you can learn from the maintenance end and just the program end in general, I think it's pretty vast, and there are connections there from everything to, you know, money management to working a job, you name it. There's a lot that can be talked through a mountain bike program.
Yeah. Super cool. So you kind of mentioned earlier in the conversation, your hometown, Chattanooga, Tennessee, where the mountain bike community has been able to build out a pretty substantial network of trails over the last 5 to 10 years. Tell us a little bit more about the community there and what's going on in the mountain bike scene.
Yeah. So I lived in Dalton for about 10 years, and that's really where my strongest ties are now. I still have, personally, I have a business that's based out of there too, even though I've moved back to Chattanooga. But, there are amazing. There's world-class single track, in my opinion, in both of those communities. Mm-hmm. In terms of what's being built that's new, I know Northwest Georgia Sorba is, I think they're working on something called Buzzard's Roost right now. Hmm. And that's the chapter that I'm a member of. I've got a 6-year-old now, so I'm not quite as involved as I was you know, 10 years ago, but, you know, maintenance of the stuff that we already have, we've already got just treasures. You know, we have pearls with, the Snake Creek Gap Time Trial. People come from all over North America to ride that thing. I want to say last year we had people from Australia that rode. And I was listening to, one of your shows a while back, the guy in California, I want to say his name is Greg Williams. Is that right?
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about economic impact and stuff that the trail systems have on local communities. I can tell you firsthand that like the entire city of Dalton is fully aware of the economic impact of mountain biking just because of that Snake Creek Gap Time Trial.
Yeah.
It used to be the first January and February and March, the first Saturday of each of those months. Now I think they've backed it off to two. I think it's just February and March now, but, they had over 500 riders. So you've got to assume, you know, at least one, maybe at least double that probably in terms of folks that actually show up and stay in Dalton those weekends. And, you know, if you're talking about a town of 30,000 people, which is what downtown Dalton is, and all of a sudden you have 1,000 tourists pop in for a weekend, that's a big deal. And, anyway, I got a little sidetracked there, but
yeah, Snake Creek. I mean, yeah, I've raced that one, and yeah, I mean, it's always just incredible to see all the volunteers and people that show up. I mean, I imagine a lot of them are not even mountain bikers. I mean, they're just people in the community who, like you said, they understand and appreciate, you know, sort of the impact that mountain biking has, and they want to, you know, use that in a positive way to impact the community. And yeah, it's always just really cool to see stuff like that happening.
Oh yeah, I mean, you see folks from the Kiwanis Club and the Rotary Club that show up to help and facilitate and volunteer during that. Local high schools. I mean, we've actually sent Boys and Girls Club kids out there. Kids that were participants in the mountain bike program have gone and volunteered at the Snake Creek Gap, and the Boys and Girls Club actually for a number of years would let Sorba, Northwest Georgia Sorba, use their buses to shuttle riders.
Oh, cool.
to the starting point. So, you know, very much a symbiotic relationship between the Sorba chapters and the Boys and Girls Club, and then obviously the Scaola Foundation too. So,
yeah. Well, you know, it sounds like your dad sort of got you started biking at an early age, and now you have a 6-year-old of your own. So how do you see sort of mountain biking playing out for the next generation, and sort of how you'll, you know, how you see your kids embracing it or not?
So he's fiercely independent, and and orange is his favorite color. So he has a shiny new orange Trek, and we've done numerous kind of trips out to try and get us styled in on the bike, and we're not there yet, but we have it is on our list of goals that he has taped up onto his wall for the year. But you know, he's gotten in pretty heavy to some baseball stuff, and so I'm trying to kind of facilitate and nurture that. But after college, I really got into adventure racing, and we were doing some 24-hour races and those types of things, and traveling all over. And I have in my mind that one day I really loved that. It was one of my favorite things I've done. I mean, and you get a lot of time on the bike in adventure racing, a lot of time. And I have it in my mind that one day, you know, and he's 15, 16, 17 years old, we're gonna maybe break off a couple adventure races a year, and that we'll be able to do some of that together. So that's kind of my hope. But you know, I have a feeling that he's probably going to be like most of the kids at the Boys and Girls Club, as long as I keep bumping him into it and taking him to some races here and there and watching some on TV and taking him to local trails with me. I got a feeling before long it's going to stick. It's pretty much impossible for it not to.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting with kids. I mean, they're right. They're all different. And yeah, some of them are just really into it on their own. Other ones are not. And you know, for those, if you push them, then they resist it even more. So yeah, it's kind of like everybody's gotta figure out their own way. I found with my own son, you know, if I can get him to watch like a, you know, 5-minute YouTube shred it with people doing rad stuff on bikes. Then he's really jazzed. He wants to go out and do it himself for a little bit. So that's really cool to see.
I'm going to take your advice on that. I'm going to do some of that this week.
Right. Power of YouTube.
That's right. It's amazing.
You know, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are hearing this and are really interested in knowing how they can help out or how they can be involved in maybe the Scale Up Foundation programs specifically or just in general. So what's like some action steps for people to take?
Yeah, action steps, I think first off would be to visit our new website. It's pedalup.org, pedalup.org.
Okay.
And then you can email me directly. It's just Jason, J-A-S-O-N, at pedalup.org. This is what we're looking for and what I need. And I guess part of the reason I reached out to you is I need Sorba chapters that have an interest in kind of fostering one of these programs at the local Boys and Girls Club near them. And so if you're a member of a Sorba chapter or know someone who is, and you think you might have a Boys and Girls Club in your area, reach out to me or reach out to them and tell them about this grant opportunity. Like I said, we're trying to do at least 4 a year. And it's up to about $25,000 per grant. So we can make something happen. We still have 1 or 2 slots available for this year, as a matter of fact.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, that's what we need. We need folks, you know, mountain biking culture, it's very unique. It's certainly in most cases, it doesn't have a lot of crossover with Boys and Girls Club culture. So we need local Sorba chapters to take an interest in these young people in this particular program and say, hey, you know, this is going to be a great way to put some kids on mountain bikes that probably otherwise would never have that opportunity. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily take a lot of time. Typically 1 or 2 work days a year on site is all it needs to maintain. And just some, you know, time and love and care, meeting with the kids, telling them how to take a turn, you know, telling them how to brake properly. Same thing with the staff at the Boys and Girls Club. That's a big part of the interaction is kind of coaching the staff up on how to coach the kids up. It doesn't take a lot of that to get them at a point where they can, you know, really have some fun with the bikes and the facility. So that's what we're after. That's what we're looking for. It's awareness at this point. If you can get in touch with me and or get in touch with local Sorba chapter or local Boys and Girls Club, we can probably figure out a way to make something happen. And that's what we want to do. We want more kids on bikes, more days. That's what we're after.
Cool. And can folks make individual financial contributions as well? Or is that?
100%. And that would go directly to the Boys and Girls Club and whichever one is in your community, which is great because that means your dollar is staying in your backyard. We are not in the business of receiving grants right now or donations. Mm-hmm. We're in the business of giving them. So we're in the grant making business. And so we're not asking for donations. We're just asking you to help us give donations. So it's a pretty easy sell in that regard. But so that's what happens. A lot of times is we'll start a new program, let's say in Cleveland, Tennessee, where we have 2 now. And our Bradley County and Polk County areas in Tennessee. And so we have 2 clubs up there that are running the mountain bike program. And then they'll get donations from local cyclists to help fund it in perpetuity. Our gift is to help get it started, right? To get the facility, to get the bikes, to, you know, get the things that we need to get the program in place and get it moving forward. And then ideally, the local cyclist in the community and the local donors in the community will see the value of the program, the value of introducing mountain biking to these young people, and then they'll help carry the annual operations forward. And once you have the facility and the bikes and all that kind of stuff, the cost to sort of maintain at that point is greatly reduced after you've had the tracks built and the initial bikes bought and those types of things. So,
yeah. Very cool. Well, Jason, thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about the Pedal Up program and for all that you're doing to support it.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate the opportunity. Love your show. Thanks to all your listeners out there. It's a real blessing for you to give us the opportunity to come talk with you today. Thank you.
Great. Well, like Jason said, you can learn more at pedalup.org, and we'll have that link for you in the show notes. That's all I've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.